From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Violence against women is an epidemic that we are acknowledging and demanding justice for in larger than ever numbers in the era of hashtag MeToo. But violence that occurs in the home between domestic partners, the kind that we call domestic violence or intimate violence, is still unfortunately deeply invisibilized. A new and timely book called No Visible Bruises explores in visceral detail the toll of such violence on its victims. Its author is Rachel Louise Snyder, associate professor at American University. She's the award-winning author of her earlier book, Fugitive Denim, A Moving Story of People and Pants in the Borderless World of Global Trade. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, New York Times Magazine, The Washington Post, New Republic, and more. She joins me to discuss this new book, No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. Welcome to the program, Rachel.
Thank you for having me.
So you won your award for this book, the J. Anthony Lucas Award, and certainly well-deserved. In looking through your book, it seems like this is very much a book for our times. How do we define domestic violence? And of course, that's a term that doesn't really do justice to the depth of that violence. But we have so many different kinds of violence against women, right? Sexual assault and rape and the kinds of violence that can occur between strangers. But how do you define domestic violence?
Well, I mean, the problem isn't so much the definition as what we call it. You know, domestic violence is, of course, violence against someone that you know, generally that you claim to love. It could be a heteronormative couple, man against woman or woman against man. Of course, you know, same-sex couples, LGBTQ, parents against children, children against elder care, elders. So there's a lot of different variations that are included in that term domestic violence. But the problem for me is that it's so abstract, it doesn't capture really what it's like to live inside one of those relationships, what it's like to live in a house where that kind of violence is prevalent.
What led you to exploring this phenomenon? You've done work around the world on different issues, but why this kind of violence?
You know, I guess there's really two reasons. The first is that all the other stories I ever did that had to do with women and women's disempowerment around the world always had domestic violence embedded in them somewhere. So whether it was child brides or women jailed for love crimes or women forcibly sterilized by governments or whatever the issue was, domestic violence always was kind of adjacent to whatever was going on. And the other thing was that I realized we really have not had a public conversation about this. We're starting to have conversations about sexual assault in the Me Too era, but we're not having those conversations about domestic violence in the same way that we do with other social issues, you know, poverty or homelessness or mental health issues. We don't have any of those, anything like that with domestic violence. And I felt like it was time.
You begin your book telling us a story of a woman named Michelle Monson Mosier, whose father you went to meet and interview. Tell us her story.
Michelle was in some ways very typical. She was raised in a middle-class home. Her parents were divorced. She had two sisters, two very involved, loving parents. And she met a guy named Rocky when she was 14 years old. He was 24. And she was pregnant shortly after, had two kids by the time she graduated from high school. And eventually, when she was 23 years old, he killed her two children, and then killed himself. That is the Reader's Digest version of her story. But of course, as is always true of domestic violence, it's much more complicated and nuanced than it seems.
And this whole idea of domestic violence being a crime is unfortunately a relatively new-ish phenomenon if you look at the history of civilization. And in some countries, maybe it's not even that, right?
Not even that, yeah. I mean, it's stunning to me to think that, you know, we in the United States, we think of ourselves as very progressive, as very modern. You know, we grew up thinking, being told all the time, this is the best country in the world. And yet we didn't have a federal law here in the States against spousal abuse until 1984.
Wow.
You know, you look at the whole history of humanity, and that is just a shocking fact. But there are plenty of countries today that are that have decriminalized or don't have criminal charges at all against spousal abuse. Especially husbands against wives, right? Which is, you know, the majority of domestic violence. Although I do think it's underreported in, for example, Native American or indigenous communities and immigrant communities and LGBTQ communities. I think it's underreported and certainly under-resourced. But so there are many countries, Russia, Turkey, Iran, where there are no real laws against violence against women. And then there are other countries like Ireland and France, where their laws are quite progressive. Certainly much more progressive than anything we have here in the States.
Here, every 5 years, when the Reauthorization for the Violence Against Women Act comes about, we tend to have these political battles that play out on something that should not be an issue to be battled over, right? I mean, doesn't that even also reflect our reticence to treat this as the serious crime it is?
Well, in fact, the Violence Against Women Act, or VAWA, as it's typically referred to, has been apolitical since its inception up until about 2013. In 2013, it became politicized and suddenly became for the first time ever, Republicans didn't want to get behind it because the Democrats had written further protections for immigrant communities, for LGBTQ communities, and the Republicans didn't want they were uncomfortable with that extra resourcing. So it became politicized then. It did eventually pass in 2013, but now we see the 2018 Violence Against Women Act still has not passed. It passed in the House, has not passed in the Senate, and for the first time ever, doesn't have a single Republican co-sponsor. For the first time ever, it's just unconscionable to me. And it speaks, of course, to this larger problem that you're alluding to, which is how we see the safety of women and whether or not we prioritize the safety of women in those intimate partner relationships or whether we're prioritizing other things.
I want to go back to the story of Michelle Monson-Mosier. In your book, No Visible Bruises, you spend a lot of time telling the story of the family of Michelle herself, of her partner Rocky, of their children. And I'm wondering why you spend so much time giving us those intimate details and going through their family dynamic.
You know, as a writer, my real challenge was how to get something that people have a very casual acquaintance with to really speak to them. And that really was the driving question behind how I wrote the book. I wanted readers to experience the loss of Michelle and her children and Rocky too. And the only way to do that is to make those people come alive as much as possible. And so, you know, I have a background in fiction writing. And so I approached the problem of how easy it is to turn away for people in this country. I really approached that as a fiction writer and was like, okay, how can I make us care? We know how this story ends. We know from page one of the book that Michelle is going to be killed with her children by her husband. So we know that. So what is going to compel someone to read further. And that really dictated a lot of how I approached this book, because that is what's at stake. What's at stake is that we are losing 4 women a day in this country to domestic violence homicide. 4 women a day. I mean, it's unbelievable.
And
every minute, 20 people are beat up in this country. Every minute, 20 people are assaulted by people they love.
And then while you were in the middle of your book tour, your own personal social circle was rocked by exactly this type of story. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened when you were on book tour talking about a book about domestic violence?
It's a savage irony is the only way I can put it. And I'm somewhat limited because it's still ongoing, but mm-hmm. June 7th, I got off a plane. I had done an event in Ohio the night before and I got off a flight. And my daughter's close friend's parents, he had killed the mother and then killed himself. And his sister, so the father's sister, has been a dear friend of mine for 20 years. So I had multiple overlaps with this family. My daughter was a friend of theirs, and then the sister was a really good friend of mine. And it knocked me sideways. It's not like I don't expect domestic violence homicide to happen everywhere. Of course, I know as a researcher that it happens everywhere, that it runs across, demographic lines and socioeconomic lines and racial and cultural lines. I know all that, but I guess I'm like everybody. I feel like even I would be able to see something or know something, and I didn't. I knew that they were going through a really, really toxic divorce. I don't think that's unusual. Many people go through toxic divorces. I went through one myself. The drastic measures taken have really shaken our whole community. And I still am searching for words, for the way to write about it and think about it and make sense of it, I guess. And, mm-hmm. and what is the takeaway?
And the fact that that you didn't see it coming, and possibly people around even closer may not have seen that coming, is that a disturbing hallmark of many cases of domestic violence?
I mean, it is and it isn't. You know, in fact, most domestic violence homicides have a certain set of risk factors that are common. And those risk factors tend to be on, not tend to be, they are on the Danger Assessment website. It's called dangerassessment.org. Anybody can look it up. There are 20 high risk indicators for domestic violence homicide. And they're things like, are there biological children in the home that don't belong to the abusing partner? Is there ownership or access of a gun? Is there substance abuse? Is there economic instability? Is there strangulation, which is a different category of violence than or dangerousness than like a punch? So all of these risk factors, really only like 2 of them were in the situation with my friends. I think had there been any kind of physical abuse or I didn't know the couple super well. I knew them to drop off my children at play dates. I had drinks a couple of times with the mom, but it was really his sister who I'm really, really close to. And then the 2 daughters. So I wasn't close enough to the actual couple who are dead now to be able to do it sort of post-mortem danger assessment on them. Someday I would like to. I think it's a little too early still at this point. But in most cases of domestic violence homicide, you can look back and see 17 or 18 of those risk factors apparent there.
In your book and the research you did for your book, the stories you explored, did you get a chance to talk to a perpetrator and try to get inside their mind?
Sure, many. Yeah, the entire second section of the book mm-hmm. is devoted to that perspective, because I feel like, when we pay attention to domestic violence at all, those of us who are in the media, we always tell things from a victim's perspective, which is the primary and most important perspective. But it also means that we're not expanding our research, and we're not trying to figure out the ways in which we can address the violence at its origin. So I sat in on batterers intervention groups, or offender intervention groups, if you will, all over the country. And, you know, there were things that were common. You know, they tended to be narcissistic. They tended to rationalize their own behavior. They tended to minimize the violent incidents that they were involved in. All of those things were true. But they also were just everyday guys. Like, these are guys I would have had a beer with. It was deeply unsettling to see that, because I always felt as an educated woman, oh, I'd be able to pick out an abuser, so I wouldn't date that person, or I'd have some, you know, antenna that comes up. And I learned that really wasn't true. Anybody could end up in the situation of either being an abuser or being a victim at any point.
Did the men that were abusers see themselves as abusers?
No, right. Very rarely. I mean, it depended on the program. There were certain programs that made them sort of own their violence or own their proclivity toward violence, but that didn't come immediately. That sense of self-awareness that came maybe months into a program. And for some of the men, you know, pretty much all the batterer intervention groups I sat in with were with men who are court ordered to be there. So they're court ordered to be there. Many of them are on GPS. Many of them have just been released from jail for various, you know, domestic violence offenses. And they're still not calling themselves violent. They're still not seeing that. Or if they see it in their cell, in themselves, and they have come from a home where there was violence, which is true of many, many of them, they didn't see their fathers as violent. Instead, they empathized with their fathers, and they talked about their mothers provoking that violence. So, you know, there's really a disconnect between people's behavior and how people see themselves in the world.
I'm just thinking of, as a mother of two boys, thinking about how boys internalize the social cues that they see around them as they grow up. And I suppose this is the sort of thing that people, you know, refer to these days as toxic masculinity in our culture. And of course, this is a cultural phenomenon, right?
It is. I mean, it certainly spans multiple cultures. It's certainly right. Not just American, but I do think that, you know, for me, it's language is so important as a writer. And, you know, I've had many people say, like, there's nothing wrong with masculinity, which is absolutely true. Like, masculinity is necessary, right? It's adding that adjective, that word toxic, onto it that makes it so dangerous. And so I do think when we have, it's very difficult. I mean, I empathize with you as a mother. I'm raising a girl and I have a sort of different set of problems, but, you know, how do we say to our children, yeah, these are our leaders, but you don't want to emulate them, you know, or yes, these are our leaders, but that's not really the way we should talk in public. Right. I don't know the answer to that, other than that I would like to not limit boys as we raise them, right? Their emotional constellation, their pain, their sense of self, their emotional intelligence, all of these things need to be cultivated in boys as they have been in girls for decades.
So after writing this book, or even really, I should say, as part of your book, what are the recommendations that you put forward to tackle this issue, at least on a legal, within a legal framework, or, you know, just in seeing how our laws, which are there, ought to be applied better or maybe changed? I mean, we have the task of changing our culture, but what about the basic task of even changing our system?
That is a complicated question, and I feel like I'd like to give a complicated answer to it, I guess. The first is that I don't think laws change until society changes. I think that change comes from society demanding those changes, and then policy follows. So if you look at the suffrage, or you look at the civil rights movement, or you look at the union movement, all of those laws came about because society demanded it. So I don't think you can divorce the need for cultural and social change from the advent of policy change. So the first thing I would do is, to say to people, we need to normalize these conversations within our own homes. Like in the same way that during the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, millions of women around this country were calling their husbands, their fathers, their brothers, their male friends, and telling them, oh, this happened to me when I was 13, or this happened to me when I was 15. These kinds of conversations need to happen around domestic violence. The other thing I would say is not policy oriented necessarily, but is program oriented, that I think we cannot arrest our way out of this. We have huge problems in this country with mass incarceration, of course, and with, you know, the racism inherent with mass incarceration. And you cannot add domestic violence into that and say we need to arrest and imprison our way out of it, because people don't come out of prison as less peaceful, as less violent. So I would look at some of the programs that are operating in other countries that we currently don't have here, that offer different kinds of behaviors and skill sets and knowledge to abusers. So for example, there's a program I heard about in another country that I'm hoping to look into a little bit more, that is for men, specifically men at the moment convicted of misdemeanor domestic violence, sort of low level violence. And rather than sending them to jail, they send them for 4 months, I think a minimum of 4 months, to a kind of halfway house where they go off to their job during the day, so they're still able to maintain that economic security for themselves. And then at night, they have group counseling and individual counseling and therapy. And they also learn things like housework and childcare and schedule management and all those kind of hidden tasks that women take on over and over and over again that men don't see. Right. Wow. And to me, that is really effective. There's also like batterers groups that have sitting adjacent to them, parenting groups. I think those kinds of things are particularly effective. And neither one of those solutions, if you will, involve policy changes necessarily. But they're things that we as communities can do right now. I can answer a little more about the policy if you want me to.
Sure. I mean, you know, because one of the things that I was reading about was how often to prosecute abusers, victims are expected to be part of the process and are expected to cooperate. And it hinges on their cooperation, and that can hamper investigations.
Yeah, there's sort of two problems with our policy currently, as I would see it. One is that, yes, too often they require victim cooperation, which is controversial, because our Constitution says, you know, you should be able to face your accuser. The problem is that we didn't have the knowledge and the nuance when the Constitution was written that we have now. And so we know that putting a victim in a room with an abuser and forcing her to testify in front of him further traumatizes her, and also puts her in a much dangerous situation, because she's going to have to continue to negotiate with that abuser once he's out of prison, or once he's out of whatever it is that he is, forced to as recompense, especially if they have children together. And so there should be more evidence-based prosecution with domestic violence cases. Police need to be trained to look for other types of evidence other than just the proverbial bruise, right? All kinds of trainings and programs that I talk about in the book for that. The other issue is that a lot of judges equate anger management with batterers intervention. And people ask me, like, who did you write this book for? Or who would you like to read this book? And of course, my answer has been everyone, but also specifically judges. Because when they sentence somebody like Ray Rice to anger management, what they're really saying is, I have no idea about the difference as a crime between domestic violence and other types of violence. And that means that they are missing all the important factors of that crime. You know, only about 25% of abusers fit that rageaholic that we envision. The other 75%, it's about power and control. They're enraged and they're trying to control one specific person. They know how to act at their job. They're not raging against their coworkers or their their, you know, kids' teachers or whatever. It's one person. And so anger management is not something that should be conflated with batterer's intervention.
Right. Finally, Rachel, I'm wondering, since we've been talking a lot about language in this conversation, and it's so important to you, as you were saying, we started out talking about how the term domestic violence is just, you know, an inadequate term. What would you like to see, or have you thought about a better term to describe this kind of violence?
Thought about that for a decade.
The search goes on.
Profound failing as a writer and journalist is that I have failed so far to come up with a better term. I mean, I do think that a lot of researchers have been calling it intimate partner terrorism for a lot of years. I think that I don't like the word partner in there because it implies just one type of relationship. But I do think intimate terrorism is a much better term. You know, back to the Michelle Mosier story in Montana, who I opened my book with, who was killed when she was 23. One of the things that her husband would do, there were two things that were particularly chilling to me. One is he would take the kids when he was mad at her, and he would go to a motel for the night or go camping, and she'd be sick with worry, not knowing what was happening, where they were. And so he coerced her into like compliance and obedience by taking the kids, which is not uncommon. And the other thing he did, which is equally chilling, is he went out to the outskirts of the city where they lived, got a rattlesnake and brought it home and kept it in a cage and told her, I'm going to put this in bed with you if you don't do what I say. Those two things don't involve any kind of physical violence at all. And yet, what do you call that? You don't call that domestic violence. I mean, that is a form of terrorism. There's a reason that researchers today are looking at the neurological makeup of domestic violence victims and comparing them to prisoners of war. It's intimate terrorism.
Wow. I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Rachel, and for sharing your time with us and for writing this very important book. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Rachel Louise Snyder. She's an associate professor at American University. We've been discussing her latest book, No Visible Bruises: What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.